like, honestly, I love fetishes, but yeah, just that was surprising.
Welcome to Vassals of King's Graves, a review of House of the Dragon, Season 1, Episode 9. My name is Patrick the Tall, and I welcome you to this deep dive of this episode called The Green Council. We here at Vassals of King's Grave are an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire, and we pride ourselves on spoiling everything about the books and the show, except for past Season 5 of Game of Thrones. We are everywhere you want to find us, both on Spotify and YouTube. And we also have a Discord if you would like to join us in the discussion, both in text or maybe in a future time on an episode. I am joined here today by Jock.
I am Jock. I'm also Jock on Discord.
Sarah.
Hey, it's Sarah, a.k.a. Dr. Blood.
Michael.
Hey, Carl Wadegi on the Discord.
Marie.
Hi, everyone. Mary Nymeria on Discord.
David.
Hi, I'm David. David HHH on the Discord and everywhere else.
L.
Hey, guys. It's L, a.k.a. Nettles.
Yeah. And maybe Bina will join us later if she...
I'm here. Hi, it's Bina 007.
Okay, welcome, Bina. Well, we just... we had a bit of technical issues last time, so we're going to just try to jump directly into the lemon cake review of this episode. So, Bina, would you like to start with your lemon cake review?
Short and sweet. I'm giving this 5 lemon cakes despite the foot fetish. It gives me everything I need, which is politics, character ambiguity to be debated, particularly keen on discussing whether Alicent's vacillating between naivety and being political players deliberate, or a flaw in the writing, but the writing has been so strong this season, I'm choosing to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I really enjoyed this episode.
Thank you. Jock?
Yeah, I'll give it a 4 out of 5. Some scenes I felt went on a bit much, but other than that, I can't really find any other problems with it. Played a great episode.
Great. Sarah?
I've been holding out my 5 out of 5, but after watching this episode, I'm not sure what else I'm waiting for. So I'm just going to go for it and say 5 out of 5. I think this was brilliant. It was as brilliant as the scene has been. The way that they're managing audience expectations and perceptions and just putting all of this incredible nuance into, I feel like, every moment of everything that we're seeing. I'm just loving it. So yeah, 5 out of 5 for sure.
Yeah. And, Michael?
4.5 out of 5. I really enjoyed the narrowed focus on King's Landing, as well as the expanse to the areas of the small folk that we typically don't see, as well as the increased focus on their perspective throughout the story, which is obviously going to be important.
Great. Marie?
I'll join the 5 out of 5 lemon cakes team. I really loved it. Lots of politics. I thought it was very... like, the tension was really right throughout, and there's not that much happening in terms of action, but it's so full and packed with lots of interesting character development. So, yeah, 5.
David?
For once, I'm going to be below, I think. So, because I have been generally one of the higher raters of us, but I felt like this one, the first council scenes and the coronation scenes were really great at the beginning and end, but I felt like it kind of lost its way in the middle a little bit there, where it seemed like they were kind of spinning plates just to get to, you know, to take up time before we get to the big moments before our season finale. And I felt like the whole, like, hunt for the king seemed a little weird, given that, like, both sides we were looking for were basically on the same side, with only the main difference being, you know, that Alicent wanted to push Aegon more towards Mercy. But otherwise, there were also, like, sections where I wasn't sure what was going on and why they were doing things and stuff like that. But overall, I still enjoyed it. It's still great television, and big ending and heading into next week, which I'm very excited for, as all war is going to break out. Spoilers.
How about you, Elle?
5 out of 5. It was an outstanding episode. I enjoyed every minute of it, every scene. Definitely had some reservations, but despite that, I thought that it was very tight. Maybe those questions that I do have, which we'll probably be discussing later, the way that it brought it up in the scenes, I think it kind of contributed to how good the episode was. This was definitely a big one for me. Checked all my boxes.
There you go.
Cool. I really enjoyed it as well. It's a 5 out of 5. Everything that you said, you guys said. Also, it really does have a lot of good themes to, and a lot of good questions to ask about what's going to happen next. What do we think happened with this person? And so on and so forth. Why does he like feet so much? Those things. So I think as a podcaster as well, I enjoyed this episode because it's good. We can keep it focused, but with some good questions, I think. So on that note, let's try keeping it focused. Focused on the first theme, which is discovering the king's death. And the way I summed it up was that a servant boy discovers the king off camera, tells the queen's handmaiden, and then the word starts to spread from there. Alicent and Hightower discuss the perceived last wish of the king to name Aegon his heir instead of Rhaenyra. They gather the small council, and they set in motion the plan that was already formed and ready for execution. The queen and Lord Beesbury were not included in these dealings. In the end, we are a council member and a Lord Commander shorter, and the Queen is working against the plan to kill the Blacks. And I just want to say, to begin with, just start it out, I thought the whole scene where the boys running through the castle, the keep, and even before that, we got like a whole like dreamlike, it felt like there was like the stranger was there, like death was in the halls. I felt even... It harkened a little back to when Daenerys, she had a vision of the Red Keep with all the snow. So did you guys also feel that? Or did you think that the boy was some, like, a lord or something?
I just assumed he was a servant. But as you say, I like the focus on, you said it very eloquently pre-record, the idea that the palace is never asleep because it always has to minister to these higher-ups. And that they would naturally be the first to know and to hear. I thought it was really evocative. And I was strangely moved, maybe a bit like Alicent, strangely moved at the death of this wonderful king. And so pleased to see him being called Aegon the Peacemaker or whatever his name was. I mean, it's kind of like...
Viserys, you mean Viserys the Peaceful?
Viserys the Peaceful. Yeah, I mean, I just thought it was really beautiful, beautifully handled. Did any of you all think before you realised Alicent's naivete at the small council... Did any of you wonder if he had been poisoned, which is what Lord Beesbury alleges?
No, I never. I wondered if she was going to, especially as she was pouring the tea in the last scene. But she was so, I don't know how, like, pure is like the best way. Like, her reactions are so organic and beautiful, the way that they're played. And I couldn't read that in her or really in anyone else. And then his final moments were so beautiful. Like, I don't know. I think it would be robbing something to sort of not make it a genuine just passing.
I agree. I just thought, because of what Lord Beesbury said, and I thought, well, why would the Greens have done it? Like, it doesn't seem that, like, their plans were ready, you know, like, if they'd done it, they would have had all these plans. They all seemed quite surprised and ready to then get activated.
Yeah, I agree on Alicent's reaction. That seems very genuine to me. But also, the whole thing about this show is that they're trying to humanize the Greens a bit more. So I don't see how poisoning the king would go in that direction. I think the whole thing with Alicent being actually sad is very well done, and it is there to make us sympathize with her more.
I think Beesbury's suspicion is more in line with the fact that Viserys supposedly changed his mind, which, as many characters do point out throughout this episode, for the past 20 years, Viserys has been pretty firm. And I just was happy that people were calling out BS on Alicent's stated motivation. I was like, listen, truth.
But wasn't that also like a comment in the Fire and Blood or the World of Ice and Fire, where it was like maybe there was some foul play, but we don't really know? I think that's also like a harken to that, harken back to that idea that it's written sort of.
It is a fascinating one, though, isn't it? Because I think it speaks to the ambiguity around Alicent, because she's been married. I mean, they haven't aged her up sufficiently, so you kind of forget until you see her with her kids. She's been married to this guy for decades. So, you know, the reaction is genuine, I think, when he's dying the gasp. But she vacillates between being a player and not a player. She feels naive to the fact that her father and his followers have a plan to put in place for a coup d'etat. She feels naive, or she comes across to me as naive in saying these final words from Viserys and expecting people, or herself believing them, that he's changed his mind. So she feels kind of like, for someone who, I mean, how old is she at this point? Like mid-30s or so? She just, well, maybe earlier, maybe late 20s, but she comes across as early season Sansa, like so naive. And then she's kind of, but at the same time, she's doing the whole foot fetish thing with Laris and kind of acknowledging that kind of by doing this, she's getting info. Is she a player? I mean, if she's a player, she's a bad player. I find her very slippery.
I think she is, I don't want to say deluded by her faith, but I think that the what she said to Rhaenys about how, you know, we can't have power for ourselves, but we can guide the men in our lives to be more peaceful. And I feel like that is the sort of keystone to her character, that like she truly believes that. And whether you want to see that as naivete, I think it's certainly possible in a world with like Otto's and Larissa's and stuff. But I mean, I think her clap back to Otto that, you know, not wantonly destroying lives is not a weakness. I think there is a kind of quiet strength in her that she could even believe that she could make that happen, or that that could be possible.
I think she's right in principle, isn't she? And I applauded her in her attempts to, she seems to want the realm to be governed well beyond anything. And maybe she does feel like early season Sansa and, you know, conventional women of that time, that your power is exerted subtly through the men who rule. But then she herself acknowledges that her son is an imbecile, is morally, you know, for a woman who's religious and seems to be motivated by religion, is morally well, I don't know what you want to say about him and the little kids, but
that's really weird, actually.
She wants to rule well through a man, but she wants to put this specific man on the throne that she knows has raped a girl, that she knows is often weird ass brothels that cater to weird ass tastes, and who has no interest in governing. And when he asks her for love, kind of shoves him away from her. So again, it's just part of this real contradiction and ambiguity that I find fascinating, but also I really worry it's potentially bad writing. But I don't know.
I do think it's purposeful. It's there for a reason. I don't think it's bad writing. I think it's a choice, or I prefer to think that because I think for me, Alicent is, she is a player. She wants to be, but she has this genuine, I would not say kindness, but like she cannot really imagine just ordering the murder of a whole family. And I think that's a strength and not a weakness, but you can see it both ways. But to me, she's not stupid. There's just things that she cannot really conceive, like other characters can. So she's not exactly on the same level as them, but more because it does not seem like an option to her.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's easy for her to be pious. So easy for her to be pious that she cannot understand why other people cannot be as her. It's inconceivable almost. And that's also what makes her kind of annoying to a lot of people around her. And I think also that what really like rubbed me the wrong way to begin with, that she was sort of, you know, entitled and angry about people not being as her to begin with. But I'm starting to warm up on her. I actually wrote in my notes, this is more like my Alicent, because she's still caring and warm and she wants to do good, not just to be holier than thou, which is much better, I think. I think this episode really showed the dichotomy between her, you know, her love and the religion that she is led, like, she leads by.
This was kind of something that I said back when we were debating whether or not she was playing the game to marry Viserys. And I think her underlying motivation is just trying to feel safe, right? And whether that feels safe because the Seven are watching over you, or whether it feels safe because, you know, you're married to a man who's genuinely kind and powerful enough to look after you, or whether you feel safe because, you know, at least you have Larys on your side and this is what it takes to get him, but you know he can get things done. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's this unifying aspect to her that she just wants something to be stable or perceptible or understandable and safe.
I found her really being a kink dispenser, she really feels like that's her only coin in the game. As if she cannot provide anything else, whether it's intelligence, whether it's strategy, anything else. She feels like this is what I've been reduced to, being a kink dispenser for this guy, and this is how I'm going to get what I want and what I need, and to make sure things happen like they're supposed to. And no one dies. It was frustrating throughout the whole scene to kind of really watch that and how they broke it down, you know, foot, shoe by shoe, sock by sock, you know, looking at that and seeing that this is what I need to, this is what I have to do to get things done. And I think it really spoke to overall what I saw in the episode as this whole objectification of Allison. I really feel like you could have really called the whole entire episode that, because we saw that with every man that she dealt with throughout the whole entire episode.
Totally agree.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I think she's the ultimate example of be careful what you wish for in George's world. You know, mm-hmm. She's getting everything she wanted here and she's horrified by it, which is good. And I mean, not good that she's, you know, it's good that she's horrified. It's good characterization.
Yeah. And like on that note, I actually like the fact that she wasn't in on the whole conspiracy, and that there was something that had been clearly discussed by with other members of the council that we didn't see until now. Like, it all happened off screen. We didn't know about it. And like the way, Without that, the whole season feels a bit cheap. Like, the war has to happen because that's what the book says, but it didn't really feel like we got a lot of tension between the characters, but not a lot of actual plotting, I think. And this showed us that the plotting was happening, and the like conspiring and making plans was actually happening, and she wasn't in on it, which I really find, I like it better this way, I think.
It also brings up an interesting point that these two main characters, Alicent and Rhaenyra, they don't plot, really. They don't, not in general, they're themselves. They try to, you know, survive, whatever. Rhaenyra less so, I would say, but it seems like the Game of Thrones in this, you know, series is played around them less than with them, and they sort of try to get into it because they start to understand the severity of the situation. But in general, it seems like they're just the pawns in a greater game,
or like the lightning rods.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're so right, and I completely agree with Elle's characterization too. Beautifully put. And the more I think about it, the more I think she's just a cipher for people. For Otto, she's just the mother of the future king and a way to exercise power, but not worthy of being considered being brought into council. I don't think it's that he doesn't trust her, he just doesn't particularly think she's got anything to add, right? And how galling for her to find out that her husband didn't trust her with a prophecy, and now her father hasn't trusted her with a plot. And then Kristen Cole kind of idolizes her. He's got a real virgin whore complex going on. So now she's the kind of religious, the kind of purer than pure queen that he will, you know, make the idol of his zealotry without her permission, really. And then Larys, she's just someone to, you know,
you know, to use sexually. And it's actually tragic. I mean, that's the beauty of this TV show, because I'm not really a pro-green person, but I do really feel sympathy for her, even as I think she is playing the game rather badly, maybe because she's never given her permission to think of herself as a player, as Rennes would say. Beautifully acted by Olivia Cooke, I feel.
Just really quick, I know I'm in a minority, but I feel like this whole rehabilitation of Alicent, what the show is doing, is really not helping. Like, I don't think that's really doing her character any service to me. To me, it kind of reduces, it's showing a reduction of her autonomy a little bit. And I just really don't feel, I don't know if that's just really the
way. Because they're making her, right. Because in order to make her good, they're making her innocent, which actually involves them making her naive and maybe rather stupid. So, yeah.
I do like the idea that these two women are, they're so central and they're so, you know, it's the princess and the queen, right? But that in fact, like we were, you're saying, they're being played around, and that really they're figureheads at best, right? That they're not even like the, you know, the prime movers or whatever. I don't know. That's interesting. Just real quick on Cole, he remains a dumpster fire.
Yeah.
I do, Bina, I think your insight that he's using her as an idol for his zealotry helps me understand him a little bit, but like he just really needs to get his shit together. And I feel like this character that they have of him is such a downgrade from the books. Like I understood him as zealous and maybe motivated by betrayal or by, you know, dislike of Rhaenyra or whatever, but that he was part of the sort of thinking mechanism of the plot as well as just the brute force. But like the fact that he killed Beesbury by accident because like old men are fragile, I don't know, it just makes him so gross to me that he's just this blundering like violence machine. And I don't know, he just bothers me so much.
Yeah, I was just about to talk about the Beesbury situation, as we might call it. That was a bit jarring, and again we have to commence with dealings while people are still, you know, getting cold next to the thing. I think this is an ongoing theme, as are rats, of course, but it's sort of weird that we had to sit there and watch that specifically, and that he was so, you know, unfeeling towards accidentally killing someone who was an old nice person.
The religious zealot, he's on the side of right, this part, you know,
right?
I think it doesn't help again that they haven't aged him up, because they just, it makes them come across, or makes him come across as more impulsive and teenage than he would. You know, I really think they need to start aging him and Alicent up.
I think it's so interesting that he, I totally agree with that, by the way. It's really irritating that they're like forever young. But I do really like the idea that she has like her two sort of greatest assets, Cole and Laris, are both like so barely under her control. If you can even, you know what I mean? Like, he was like, there's an offense to the queen. So like theoretically he's in her service, but she was like, they're actually... wasn't you psycho? Like that they're both just right. So loose, you know.
One wrong move, exactly. One wrong move that she does is something that neither one of them likes. It could completely switch the whole dynamic.
Mm. Yeah, like a tiger by the tail, kind of, as I feel like.
Not to mention her son, Aemond. He's also sort of that same thing. Right. We can get into that a little later, but I think she is out of her depths. And that's because of those characters. They're so crazy. And I think I love the way Lord Commander of the King's Watch was, he was just disgusted with the whole thing. He did his step down very, very well without stepping on too many people's feet or anything.
Yeah, he's very much in the tradition of Sybaris and Selmy. I love knight commanders like that who are just really awesome. Like these, you know, these heads of military orders that are just very good and noble and don't want all this nonsense going on.
Did they just let him leave? Like, did they just quit and they were like, oh, bummer. Thanks for coming. You know, like, that seemed a
just
little...
A leave of absence, I guess you could say.
Yeah, because he actually didn't say that he quit. He just said that when you find a king, whoever that is, I'll come back.
Yeah, he was just, I'm on sabbatical, Lord Commander out.
Yeah.
It seems very bold, considering they just slaughtered Beesbury for, like, being...
Right. Yeah, that's the difference. He carries his sword. On that note, do we have anything else on that, or the Green Council in general?
Just that I still don't understand why the bulls are there, except maybe to get rid of Lord Beesbury eventually. The splat makes no sense.
The fact that the Lannister ball was gold was just like, God, that guy's such a... Oh, I love him and I hate him so much. He's like the perfect distillation of Lannister, and it just makes me crazy.
It's so on brand.
Very.
Those guys are such dudes.
Of course he has a gold ball.
Gold latrine and a, you know, gold toilet.
It's like Donald Trump. Everything is going to fake gold in Trump's hair. I mean, it's just that kind of personality. Totally.
But he doesn't shit gold. Lannisters don't.
Then, on that note, we'll just jump into the search for the new king, the future king, rather. Not the once and future king, but the future king. So two groups set out in search of the future king, and Sir Eric and Eric by Otto, and Sir Cold and Aemon by Alicent. What do we think about that? This is mainly just a quest bit.
Can we just back up for 1 second, like before they're deployed? Because the fact that Helena was doing a spider needlepoint was like such a high point for me. Like, it was like, you know, this dainty little, like, fucking massive Black Widow or whatever. I don't know. I love her so much. And but it's pretty clear that Aemon loves her too, right? I mean, am I shipping them on my own, or is that something that you guys perceived as well? Here, really? Oh wow!
I didn't see that.
No. Perhaps some sort of dutiful care, like, you're my sister, and I should be looking out for you because your brother husband.
So you think it's just another symptom of him thinking Aegon is inferior to himself, kind of a thing? Okay, all right.
Yeah, I think everyone knows Aegon's
a dragon,
and they're like, kind of like, he's kind of like the. Yeah, I think everyone's just like, we have to deal with him. Pull together and find strength in each other whilst having to deal with this asshole becoming king. Yeah, I think that's it. I don't see him finding anything romantic in her.
Why do you think that she jerked away? I didn't understand that after she did her beast, all the boards thing, jerked away from Alicent when Alicent tried to comfort her.
So I've been seeing a pretty, like, well-established thread of discussion that she's meant to be represented as neurodivergent, and that reactivity to touch, and the sort of, you know, fixation on topics, and her reaction to the killing in the throne room, like, that these are potentially all neurodivergent traits that they're building either into the writing or into the performance. So that may be, or it may be that she's seen something about Alicent that she doesn't... or isn't comfortable with. But I don't know. That was just, I think it's an interesting perspective on the character.
Yeah. Maybe she thinks that Alicent has something to do with it. Just, I don't know. Just throwing it out there. Okay, well, search for the king. I find that I don't like Aegon even more now because of all the things that we see during it. And it's sort of like we see Eric telling Eric about everything this and telling him we need to do something about this, or leave, or something. I'm not sure exactly what Eric wanted Eric to do, but he definitely wanted him to see all the bad stuff that Aegon had wrought. And on the other hand, Otto and Aemon are like an asshole version of a body cop show.
Right,
like, yeah. Really, they're the bad people who are walking around doing stuff, and let's see those guys over there doing their job, let's just profit on that. Yeah,
I hate their sneaking around outfits, like his stupid little brown hat and Aemon's like not fooling anybody hood, and I don't know, it's very like, I mean, just put a sign on yourself that says like sneaking around. I'm like, really, you guys? Like,
I think they have a royal costumer. I think they have like some person living in the castle outfitting them with costumes, and that's why they're also so nicely kept. Like it's like there's been rubbed grime into it, not actual grime. So it's, I think it's like they have a royal costumer. That's a fan. It's distressed, that's a theory for me.
Jeans.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think it's David. You said that you don't really get like the whole who's gonna find Aegon first, because they all want to put him on the throne anyway. So what does it matter really? But like I had a hard time understanding it as well. And then I figured that it was all about the power dynamic between Alicent and Otto. And like, even if it doesn't matter that much who finds him, like it doesn't have a lot of concrete consequences, but it has the consequence of her having the upper hand, at least for a while. And it leads to her confrontation with her father, which was really great. Like, I was really happy to see that. And so I initially didn't really get it, and then I found that I really liked it. And I think it's very subtle the way they are moving around. I mean, the way they're having these power relationships play out, and the dynamics like change and everything.
Completely agree. And I think it's kind of, in a sense, you could call this episode the awakening of Alicent, if you assume she was innocent at the start, that, oh my goodness, if you take her at her word that her mission is for peace, to be in charge, but still have peace with Rhaenyra, her only hope is to get hold of this kid first. Yeah. She knows his true nature, but if Otto finds him, then she's completely cut out of the power dynamic. Her only power is as mother to the king, so she's got to be the one who tries to speak to him about letting Rhaenyra live and brokering some kind of diplomatic peace before Otto says, no, just kill them all. Sign here, lad. Let's go. So it made total sense to me.
I would be pleased if they kind of built up on that power struggle between Otto and Alicent. Them kind of a pushing and pulling, and him kind of reducing and shutting her down with, oh, you look just like your mother, and her kind of recognizing it for the bullshit that it was, with her just storming off.
What
I think that it really be
wish the end of that
yeah
scene.
Yeah.
It was such a weird, like, yeah, it was such a weird moment. And I don't, like, he really does just want to let her, like, he's tired of fighting, or he's, I don't know. I really don't. I didn't understand, but I was curious what. Because, yeah, on the heels of you look just like your mother in certain lights was so creepy. And then, yeah, that was like what he could have said, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess we can talk about that quickly. Because for me, I think that was basically him giving her a win, so that she wouldn't become in like a actively working against him all the time, like becoming his enemy in the Game of Thrones. So seeing that it might as well end up in bloodshed anyways, because whatever this that's how it looks is gonna go with everything. So I think he's basically just saying, well, sure, I'll give you this then, and then let's see what happens.
Maybe
hard,
you'll
though. See reason. No, but like sometimes when you have kids, you're also like, you don't necessarily say to them, ah, okay, whatever, you can do what you want. You kind of go off, mumble a little to yourself, oh, whatever. And then sort of try to get back into it when you're equipped, mentally equipped to better deal with your kids and their tomfoolery. I think that was how I read it. I was like, ah, whatever. You'll get this one. I also loved Eric and Eric's dynamic. It was really, really good. I immediately understood their relationship and how one was, and the whole point of him showing us by showing his brother how unfit, or at least how not awesome Aegon is, that really, it really worked with me. It really, it was really good. Any thoughts on that?
I still don't know which one is which.
You guys know that I don't either, but that's also because they're actually twins in real life, the actors, which I thought was a kind of cool casting choice.
I mean, I've always loved this particular story, and I've always loved the part of the Arthurian legends that it's based upon. I think I do wonder, and I'm not going to spoil it for those of you who haven't watched Game of Thrones, but I do feel there's maybe an echo to this at some point there. I think George R. R. Martin is consistently inspired by and makes references to the Balin and Balan story in the Arthurian legends. So I was really I was inwardly cheered to see them, and I like the actors, and let's see where it goes. And I think that's maybe partly why I know some people have criticized this for being a bit of a slow episode, and why are we spending so much time chasing after him? But I think it maybe is to start to establish them as characters, and that the payoff will probably come in season two. So I think for the casual TV viewer who doesn't know the books, they're probably thinking, "Yeah, why the fuck?" You know, like seriously. But I think that's because they don't know how important these two and how moving and pivotal these two characters
are. Yeah, and showed us as the audience how sucky Aegon is. So it still had some purpose other than just evolving the characters and setting up this strategy that we will sadly have at some point.
Mm-hmm. I loved Eric and Eric as well, but I have no memory of what they're doing in the book, but I'm happy to find out through the show now.
Good. I shall say no more.
No, you can spoil. That's the rule here.
Is this where we get into Aegon? I posed a question on HOTD polls. If you go onto the forums, casual listener, then you will see that we do have some polls that we can post after the episodes. And I asked, who's worse? I think this was something that Dragoncast brought up. How would you rank Joffrey, Ramsay, and Aegon? And everyone put Aegon last, maybe because he's just young. I just thought, maybe Matt or someone who said on the forums or anything that they've never seen anything as disturbing as the orphans fighting each other with the sharpened teeth and shit? I mean, this is seriously weird shit. I know Ramsay's done some seriously horrific, horrific shit. And so did Joffrey, particularly in the show.
Was that his side hustle, or did he just enjoy watching it?
Yeah. Well, isn't there's one little, like, blonde little kid that I wondered whether that was one of his bastards?
I mean, that's what the twins are.
I thought that's totally what they were going for. You weren't supposed to wonder it. You're supposed to I thought it was a given that was one of his bastards.
When you have a kid and you have a fetish for kids in gladiatorial contest, and you put your own kid in it, I mean, albeit a bastard, but still. I mean, fuck's sake.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he then orchestrated the whole fight. I think he's just leaving us around, and the only thing they can go towards is child fighting,
I don't think he knows or gives cares. Shits whether or not he has kids anywhere. I mean, he's like the sort of dark side Robert, right? Where he's just kind of spreading it around. Like, I don't think he's counting by any stretch of the imagination.
I completely agree. I think he's so detached from everything. He's never had to feel any real consequences for anything. And I'm not even sure that he has the mental capacity to put two and two together and see that little kid in the corner, obviously scarred for life mentally.
But he does have moments of emotional acuity with his mum and with assessing that he doesn't want to rule. So it's not like he's not simple.
Okay, so this is maybe a little bit of reach, but I think sort of imagistically that this is an important point. I would suggest that little kid was meant to be a representation of him, and that like the kids fighting are Rhaenyra and his mom, and he's just in the corner, this like sad, broken little boy who, you know, when they drag him out from under the altar and he's addled and barely conscious, the first thing he says is, "I want my mother," you know? And like, I don't know. This episode just was so clear to me that he is a child of ceaseless mental and physical abuse, and that there's some kind of gilding that's put on that because he's either, you know, he is or is not the heir apparent, right? But like, he's just a broken boy. And, you know, the do you love me and the carriage, like, I don't know. I just found it really heartbreaking. And I feel like that like tableau of that little kid sitting in the corner in this like battle royale, it was such a moving, horrifying, gut-wrenching representation of like his emotional state.
Yeah. And, you know, we could get super Freudian here, but clearly This is a boy who seeks the approval and love of his parents that hasn't been forthcoming, because his father clearly loved Rhaenyra first of all. You know, he's grown up knowing that his father has picked another person to be heir who is a woman. So how does that make you feel? He clearly is not close to his mother. And by the end of it, we're going to see him take the complete applause of the massed crowds and get high on that. I mean, that's, oh, blimey. I mean, yeah.
The difference I would give between him and Ramsay and Joffrey, at least at this point, is that he's not actively instigating cruelty. Like, I wouldn't say that he's organizing this as his side hustle. This is just something that he wandered into and found out that he perversely enjoyed, or it made him feel alive in some way. But that's the probably why he's ranking last in terms of the who's the biggest psychopath.
Like,
I think it's the realization that he's going to get the love that he's seeking, and he's going to get that from the subjects, his subjects. Like, here at last, I'm getting what I want and what I've always, always wanted that I did not get from my parents.
I'm getting acceptance. I mean, to be fair, he does proactively rape a girl, right? I mean, like, maybe he didn't proactively do the side hustle, but he's not the innocent little broken bird who just passively realizes he gets his rocks off doing X, Y, Z. I mean, he did actively rape someone. And probably more
defend him.
I don't want to downplay that. But I mean, I do think to like to sort of build on what I was saying, like I feel of him, Joffrey and Ramsay, that he has the most sort of reasonably cracked foundation, like that we understand how he got there, and you can kind of trace the steps from like. You know, the way Alicent treated him and the way that, you know, his father treated him and stuff. Whereas like Ramsay seems to have just been born with teeth. And then like Joffrey is, I don't even know, like, I don't even know what his deal is. But
I think both Joffrey and Ramsay have a more manipulative streak that Aegon doesn't seem to have, which also makes a difference. Like it's not necessarily better than them, but there's an idea of intent and power over people that he's not going for, I think.
Well, that could bring us into the last bit of the discussion about this episode. I think we can go into the making of the king, where Otto forces the lords and ladies of the realm to bend the knee to Aegon, and Alicent disposes of a spy network, but for a price. Yuck. Later, they anoint and crown Aegon, and everything seems well until Rhaenys, escaped from captivity with the help of Sir Eric, bursts through the floor of the dragon pit on melees and flies off to warn Rhaenyra, presumably. So, rip, Lord Meriwether, Lady Fel, and Lord Caswell.
Was that Lord Caswell?
Yep.
Okay.
Did Lady Fel and Lord Meriwether, did they get hung, whatever it is, or did they just get taken to the black cells?
They will eventually, spoilers in the books, get executed for not aligning with the throne. So all those three, we will probably not see anymore. Maybe Meriwether and Lady Fel will be shown at some point to just show some gruesomeness, but. They are either dead or soon to be dead.
Because I remember in the books, there are some prisoners that get released when there's the regime change happens. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
All of them are, according to the books, killed.
Just in general, about Aegon, just really fast. How hard is that whole abdication thing?
What?
Like abdicating. How is that just not feasible?
I think it's not an option.
Yeah, not for. I mean, I don't know. I think it's the whole. If he abdicates, then it makes their whole claim weaker, because it wasn't the point that it wasn't meant for Aegon to take over the throne. It was definitely never the point meant for Aemon to take over the throne.
I think is it even a word in their vocabulary? I mean, it feels almost anachronistic in a way. I don't know historically, but like in this world, it doesn't feel like it's even an option.
Yeah, I've figured that especially.
Yeah, I mean, you do think, like, if Viserys had retired 15 years ago and just put Rhaenyra on the throne, like, it probably would have been better for him, too, but...
Yeah.
Have we ever had any kings retire and go to... I mean, there's obviously, in Game of Thrones, the Maester.
Right.
But, so there's royals who just go off to the Night's Watch and sort of take themselves out of the Game of Thrones, but are there any kings or kingly heirs who do that in the histories? Just, like, peace out and go into the Night's Watch?
Dany has a one indirect line about kings who gave up their crowns often gave up their lives, but nothing specific is mentioned.
So would Aemon be the most kind of aristocratic person that's been in the Night's Watch, probably, or the most monarchy adjacent?
Maybe. I mean, he was sent, I guess, but...
Oh, yeah? Yeah, but still, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right.
Nymeria... couple of those Dornish kings to the wall, but that was
they're minor kings.
So that's a little different.
So one question that we were talking about the hangings. When you saw Westerling hanging, did you think
Caswell.
Even for a minute wasn't Westerling hanging as well?
I thought I saw him.
I think it was only Lord Caswell. Wasn't it only Caswell? I think the two we saw in the council in the throne room. Saying not bending the knee specifically is right. Lord Meriwether and Lady Fell, and Lord Caswell sort of fainted out and tried to get away, and he's the one who was hanging up.
Okay, I thought I saw Westerling hanging, which led me to the question of did he kill himself. But in any case, continue. Sorry, you can edit that out.
Shocking lack of knowledge. That's also right? on brand.
Well, I think part of it was just everything was so dark I couldn't always tell what was going on in some of these scenes. So
yeah.
And who was who, especially in those scenes. But...
I did also today have a lot of time to overanalyze and micro inspect everything. So that's why I know all the names and everything.
I think this is the first episode that I'm looking forward to rewatching.
Yeah.
Like all the other ones I really enjoyed, but I don't necessarily think that I would get more out of them on a rewatch, although I may not be correct in that. But this one, I feel like the facial expressions and the sort of unspoken things that happened, like, were so rich that I'm looking forward to doing that kind of over-analysis on a rewatch.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was a lot of, details put into this episode that wasn't, said out loud or anything that we sort of
get to fast forward through the White Worm scene because it was like nails on a fucking chalkboard. And
what? Okay. So, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I do not agree with you and a couple other people's take on that she has a bad accent. I've heard people talk like that in real life.
I literally just heard Bina's voice in my head going, "Shay the funny whore, Shay the funny whore," like over and over again. I didn't even like process what she was saying. She has such great lines and it's just so... I don't know. I think it was such a poor choice.
I mean, I think, Patrick, you're right in one sense that there's lots of things that happen in real life. And there's lots of things that happen also in books that somehow when you put them on screen in the artificial construct of a TV show, come across as fake, even if they're perfectly real. Like you can have people speaking with that in real life, that I think you have to make a decision as a showrunner about what, even if it has verisimilitude, is going to be distracting. And the people who made this show are very well aware of what did and didn't work in Game of Thrones. And I think we're the beneficiaries of that. Like they've really listened to what fans did and didn't like and improved. And Shay the Funny Whore was something that we all didn't like. So it's kind of like, come on, guys, come on. And I think someone on the forum suggested that maybe it was you, Sarah, that next season they should just not have
an accent. It wasn't me, but I totally agree. Like I would be willing to suspend disbelief in favor of that. Yeah.
You know, like when... Yeah, when you watch early Lord of the Rings, right, the first scenes with Aragorn and even with Eowyn, they have these kind of like attempts at fake Irish accents. And even actually early episode Game of Thrones,
Peter Dinklage
is attempting some sort of weird ass accent. And then they realize it's silly and move forward and we all forgive them. So I think that they should do that.
I don't know. I don't agree. I think that it's less a problem. Also, you know... Shay the Funny Horse, that was her actual accent. She was German born and with us, it's like a sort of ethnic accent, I think. And that was just her way of speaking. So I don't think you could have done anything about that. This is a deliberate choice to make her sound foreign.
Yeah.
And not a just a regular Marinese or anything. It's more like, what was it, Sothrosi accent, that one. I get a story when I hear her accent completely alien.
Throughout the whole, I could see that being its use.
Yeah.
It just is weird to me because we're in this interesting time of TV where we're making accents not be othered. Like if you look at the amazing work they're doing in Andor, this idea that we just live in a world where the fact that you have a funny accent doesn't mean that you're other, you could actually be the lead actor. And I find that this is quite retrograde insofar as it's going back to the old days where everyone would have a cut glass English accent. We'd have one person with a German accent. He's obviously the baddie, you know. And maybe that just comes from growing up in England. But I just feel, I don't know, it makes me not happy that this is how going other.
I think that's an excellent point, Bina. I completely agree with you. And obviously no shade on like accents, you know what I mean? But I think if it had been her legitimate accent and they had just cast an accented English actor, like that's fine. Like I don't think I would be having this kind of like visceral reaction to it. But, like the fact is that it's very clearly not her accent and it stilts her line delivery and I find it very distracting and I feel like the whatever benefit there is less than the payoff. I feel the same way about what they're doing with Laris, which I have said before and we don't have to get into it. But yeah.
So is White Worm a baddie?
Ambiguous at this point. There's certainly a sinister aspect to her in that what she delves in is dark and seedy, but then you also get the sense that she has had a rough life and wants to make things better for those around her, similar to Varys in A Game of Thrones.
I feel like she gives more Clubfoot vibe, book Laris vibe, than actual Laris on the show.
Or like she has a plan or like an agenda, but it's not necessarily nefarious.
Very fluid, kind of like how Laris was, just very moving here and moving there. You're not really sure where they're going or where they're going to land. That's kind of how I saw that, as opposed to the Laris we actually got, what we have right now. That kind of stuck out to me.
I thought the thing about the fighting kids was such a, like, I don't know. It felt like a pulled punch for the fact that they showed it earlier, that they felt like they needed to have some character be like, this is wrong. We want it to stop. And I'm like, yeah, of course it's, yeah. I don't know. The whole scene just, although I did really like Otto's face when she said, like, condolences on the king. And he was just like, the fuck?
Yeah.
I think it just takes the form of the greater focus given to the small folk in this episode and their perspectives, again, which are going to become more and more important later. One small detail I wanted to point out, when they're being herded into the dragon pit, did you guys notice there were a couple of sheep being walked along?
Yes.
And there was a shepherd.
Yes.
So yep. I think that's something they're directly aware of and are trying to invoke for this episode.
We are one step closer to the dragon pit, is what I think. That scene with how the small folk were really featured in this episode. It's like, oh, give them a reason. That's definitely a great reason.
So, Laris, that's...
Can we just tell people to listen to Dragon Cast?
Okay, let's do that. Let's just agree that... is necessary, and I would say no. Is it that the thing that we talked about last time, Bina, about things adding to the show and not changing anything from the books in particular? This was not it. Let's just end it with there.
I feel like I feel like they're shorthanding his character in ways that I find very out of keeping with the nuance that they're building into what feels like every single other character. And the fact that they are leaning on first deformity and now like fetishism, I don't know. It just feels, it feels like shortcuts that are reductive and clearly meant to provoke a very specific reaction, but like in very stereotypical, I don't know.
Using the accent, right? We're just going to say something about weird foreign people. I mean, it's just quite lazy. And yeah. That isn't typically lazy. And I think it does Laris's character dirty, just as you could argue, I mean, for different reasons, Kristen and Cole. There are characters who get so much more time and effort to make them feel rounded, like Alicent, and characters where they can't be asked, yeah. like Laris.
And I get the idea that, you know, he's using her, and I that landed for me, like, in her reaction to the exchange, but...
I was saying earlier is how with some of the characters and also with the audience, there's always that sense of, from George's works and from these shows, of be careful what you wish for. Well, we've been asking in several of these episodes, like, what are his feelings towards her? Are they genuine? Are they real? And, well, we got it answered in a way we didn't really want.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually how I felt. I felt like I understand now what their dynamic is. And
right.
I think this was on the forum too, but like, how did that conversation go? Do you know what I mean? Like, was it like,
yeah, when he started
after one of the little girls' dinners, or like, he's like, you know, here's the thing about me. Like, I don't know. I just, right. it's fascinating to kind of think about like how they got to that position. But like, yeah, I
want to show you something. Okay, let me just put more on my shoes. Don't worry about that. Yikes. Well, let's move on. In the coronation, I saw it sort of appeared to me that the crown was a bit too large for Aegon's head. And it kind of reminded me of like Prince John from the Disney rendition of Robin Hood. Yeah, it's like he is definitely not his predecessor.
I expected it to slide down his neck.
Yeah. That was so good. I hoped that was just so good. And then he ended up being like a whore for the attention, and that was just, it really felt like they were trying to show him as not a worthy regent.
Very ill-suited for the position.
Mr. Dr. Blood described him as an addict, and I think that that's such a great like way to understand him, not just substance abuse, right, which he obviously does, but now his dragon that he's chasing is adoration, right? Is this you know, greater and greater levels of adoration and power, and it feeds very well into the kind of lesser addictions that he's been cultivating, whether it's sex or violence or alcohol or whatever. But I just thought that was really apt characterization.
It's sort of going to speak into the whole entitlement he's going to get, and like detachment from everything he's going to get at some point, where the fame has risen to his head and he's unable to see why people are speaking against him or doing anything, and getting outraged from that. Whilst right now he's still like, I really don't want to do this. I don't want any attention. Just let me do what I want and I'm going to be fine. But it's going to go differently for him later on. That brings me to the question, because Rhaenys, she spares a whole lot of them. She could have just shish kebabbed them or flamed them into non-existence, but she didn't. Do we think that's a good idea?
I think it's similar to you can conquer a land, but you've then got to hold it and rule it, and you don't start holding and ruling by shish kebabbing people.
Ah, but it would have been fun.
Vladimir Putin, please take note when it comes to Kiev.
Perhaps fear and terror is not enough to hold a kingdom? It's kind of building up on Baena more than just might and brutality.
Yeah, and it speaks to Rhaenys and indeed Alicent having a different idea of what it is to rule and govern in the interests of the people, that one gets the feeling that both of them actually hold the people as of value. It's not her style. I mean, I did think the whole thing was a bit possible,
And
not like, sure.
Come on. I mean, this is all just there for it. It's just there for a set piece, isn't it, at the end of episode 9? But I think it's in keeping with her character, which has always been restrained and fair and arguing her case, but within the boundaries of, you know, decorum and humanity. So, yeah.
I think it's also, in terms of the previously on, like, I don't know if you guys skipped that or not, but the line that we get from her is, the Greens land their first blow and I stand alone. And I think in that moment, it just wasn't her fight. Like, she was never going to be queen, and, you know, it was nice to acknowledge that she might have been a good one, but I think she just didn't have, like, a big enough dog in the fight at that point, and yeah, I don't know. It just wasn't enough to justify it, I think, in her mind, or to balance out the other considerations, which is cool. I mean, it's, you know, it suggests that this kind of nuclear option is one that can be avoided or chosen against, that Targaryens aren't required to use their dragons when they have the opportunity to. And that kind of poise and control is something that we rapidly lose sight of, I think.
Yeah, but then again, does mercy then prolong the suffering is my question. Is her mercy towards her family, towards a person that she can understand being Alicent, is that what prolongs the suffering in this situation? The more people will die
in this situation, because we know how it goes. We know it catastrophically spirals out, but I think it's important to remember that that is a very unlikely scenario, and it would take this certain set of dominoes to really just kill all the dragons, destroy House Targaryen's credibility and its staying power in a way that no one could have anticipated.
I mean, well,
Otto is like, destroy the few to save the many, right? I mean, that's that was right. His argument for killing the greens, or for killing blacks, and everybody thought that was crap, so... Right. Like, you know,
I mean, she could have ended the entire dance right there with one Dracarys, and she didn't. And in the end, that probably would have been for the best. But one thing I was going to say, though, is we were talking about how, you know, she shows a caring for the people. But I mean, how many people did she kill, you know, with breaking through? How many of the small folk died because she came in to make a statement, you know?
I was thinking about that. I was saying, okay, about 100, maybe 200, 300 people died there.
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, and then she didn't do anything with it. That was the weird part. Like, it was like she was making a statement. I mean, maybe she needed to break through to get out. But I mean, in the whole, like, let me turn around and confront, you know, these people that are my enemies, she that needlessly killed hundreds of people. And then she just flew off. So, I mean, like, if my wife or husband or kid had just been killed, I'd be like, well, what the fuck was the point of that?
Yeah.
I did love Otto screaming to open the door, right? Because their instinct was to close them. He's like, don't close it in here. Like, be in the car. Open all the windows.
Yeah, right. Let it out, man. It's like an angry pigeon. No, don't keep it inside.
Yeah.
Fire pigeon.
Yeah, I was just about to say that if Otto hadn't ordered the doors open, they would have fried completely, because... I don't think that Rhaenys would have kept it, you know, under control if she didn't have any place to go. I think that would have changed the dynamic a little. So that's very good. But I'm just
thinking her messaging. I mean, it might have been, you know, like, look, you have one chance to let me get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
If you try and stop me, then you know.
But how could the guards hear him over all the noise? I'm just asking.
Well, they didn't seem to. They kept pushing at the doors, but in vain, it would seem. Like, it just seemed a clusterfuck of communication.
Why did they go to the dragon pit to announce his... seems like... for plot reasons, yeah.
Wasn't it the space? Like, isn't it bigger than...
Yeah, no, I just think that this is on Visenya's Hill, right?
Yeah. Is it Rhaenys?
I think Rhaenys' Hill is where the Starry Sept is going to be.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Be built. Or the egg. Yeah. What's it called?
Sept of Baelon.
Baelon. Sept of Baelon. Yeah. Baelon's sept is going to be built. But that's still a large open area, right? So they could have done it there. It's just so many things could have gone wrong if one of the dragons had gotten out. What wish they do? So it's just weird.
Sorry, I gotta correct our shocking lack of knowledge, but the sept is on Visenya's hills and
hill. Oh, it's vice versa. Yeah,
okay, it's Rhaenys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Google.
Well, we at least know that they're named after the sisters. Otherwise, that's better than some people, I hope.
Sorry, I got you up for that.
Yeah, okay, it's fine. I did the same thing with you guys, so it's only fair. Anything else? Or we'll move into the final thoughts about this episode.
I just think that the last scene is just another stick in the fire regarding the resentment that the small folk have and how they're really gonna, you know, later on, their reactions to dragons and House Targaryen, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kindling to the fire, definitely.
Yeah, I loved Alison's reaction to her instinct to protect her children and, like, sending Crispin to Helena and protecting, I mean, quote-unquote, protecting Aegon herself.
Right.
It was touching.
Yeah, it may have seemed like a fruitless, you know, sacrifice to be like, yeah, I'm gonna stand between you and a dragon.
Which makes it more even stronger in a way. Like, well,
and more to the point, it was effective because I think it was her standing there that maybe made Rhaenys mm-hmm. change her mind. Like, oh, I don't want to really burn her, and she's a mother and I don't want to be that. So, I mean, I think that was a big part of why she didn't. Because otherwise, why was she going up to them? Like, was she just trying to make a power statement? What was the whole point of that? Like, I think she was intending to use the dragon and then went, oh, no, I don't want to do this. You know?
Maybe, yeah.
I took it more as a, like, you told me to ring the bell and now I'm ringing the fucking bell now.
The dragon bell.
Yeah, the dragon bell.
Yeah, I mean, I think that conversation between her and Alison was so stunning. It was amazing. So good, and it was so on point, and it was so moving for both of them. And I think that moment between the two of them when she's on the dragon was like that conversation part two, right? That, like, you know, mm-hmm. she's like, this is what real power looks like. This is what real freedom looks like. You have this within your reach. You know, but also, like, this is what you're up against, right? So think very carefully about, like, your next step.
Don't play chess with dragons.
Yeah.
So I think that will put us into the last few questions I have. One very short one is White Worm dead?
No.
I feel like she's going to be disfigured in, like, a very obvious but not ridiculous kind of way. Like, I don't know, it's a weird, like, you know, like, her face is fine, but, like, her whole body is burned or something like that, where just, like, there's this physical marker of, like, a lasting betrayal on their part and a grudge on hers that might feed into some of the later
Okay, so the last question is, and this is a big one, is the Faith of the Seven a prison for women?
Yes.
Because Alison...
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
No, but seriously, because Kristen Cole says when Aemon talks to him about what Aegon said when he wanted him to get bedded on the 13th name day, he says, like, we have a picture of the mother so that we learn to respect them. And it's
we really need to get into, like, the real world analogs to show why that's absolutely hollow and hypocritical.
I wanted to try to keep it within this universe so we don't get too real about it. But it seems like, and I just wanted to put forth that it's sort of like putting up this ideal of a woman, as you said before, that Kristen sort of says for the queen is what makes she is the actually Alicent is the ideal of the mother in this religion, and that's sort of both her strength and her prison, really, in a sense.
So the problem is that out of the seven, there are so few options for women, right? Like, she can either be not married or she can be a mother. There's no, and the crone, right? I mean, like, she, like, was a mother, but now she has a lamp, right? But then, like, you know, you could be the smith, you could be the warrior, you could be the father, you could be, like, there's a range that is not, first of all, tied to stages of bodily development, and second of all, no, I'm totally serious, and second of all, that's not limited to, like, the functionality of those bodies, right? That there's a choice beyond biology in the options for the father, sort of the you know, things for the father, but there's no alternative for the women. So it's this very clear, very biologically teleological trajectory that that offers no kind of alternative.
Well, I mean, it's something we've seen all throughout these books and these series, that women are basically defined in this world by their ability to have and their actual children. Like, that's really all they're valued for, and that's absolutely what this world's about.
I think the seven is pretty straightforward in that you could be either a little girl, or a broodmare, or a old biddy.
Right.
Okay, so you don't find it at all interesting to talk about that? That it's sort of I just find it so poignant, because in Game of Thrones wasn't really any characters that really like completely fit within that ideal. I mean, Sansa might be the closest.
Kat is the woman who was locked into her faith and her role as a mother, and it destroyed her because she had no lateral movement in those expectations.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, she did the best that she could within the paradigm that she was given through her faith as well as through the sort of functioning of the world, and it wasn't enough. She couldn't, there wasn't enough room to maneuver in a way that she could survive. I think
we still got something meaningful out of it. We taught me something. So on that great note, we will start to wind down this episode. And I will just want to say thank you to everyone listening and everyone participating, all the hosts, both Jock, Bina, Sarah, Michael, Marie, David, and Elle. And the next episode, if I'm not completely wrong, will be, what is that? Oh,
sorry. The Black Queen.
The Black Queen.
There we go.
The first reference to the blacks in show.
Love it. Same.
Yep.
So excited. Like Sarah, can't wait to rewatch this one, do the next one.
I was really anxious about watching this episode. Like, I had to psych myself up to turn it on, and because everything gets so, like, it just snowballs into like horror from now on, right? And that's something that I've sort of been aware of since they switched into the older cast. But this episode, like, this is such a weird, but like, this episode really made me trust that this material that's coming up is going to be handled in a way that is like real, I guess. I mean, that's sort of, it's a funny thing to say about a show about dragons, but that it's not going to be, you know, mutilated for spectacle, and it's not going to be like that. There's a soul to it, to the way that they're approaching this, and like a genuine like empathy, I guess, that I'm not afraid anymore, you guys. And I really hope that you know, a couple episodes from now, we don't replay that and laugh and then cry.
Right.
I'm still tentative on that one. I quit season 5 for specific reasons, being child violence, and well, this is sort of without spoiling too much. Something that is planned, but I think I'm better with it when it's planned than when it's just something that's two idiots figured that would
just
be good.
Just for funsies.
Yeah, it's just for funsies. Yeah. Let's just do that.
Yeah, it's not like I don't fear anymore that it's just going to be trauma for trauma's sake. I feel like they have this empathy and this like investment in, you know, all the sides of it.
In making it meaningful.
Violence, well-paced kind of thing.
And sex as well. I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because some stuff they do doesn't stick. We've discussed some of the stuff around Laris and other characters. Like, it's not that everything's successful, but I just feel they've earned our trust over these 9 episodes that the intentions are good. It may not always work, and sometimes there will be missteps, and to different people's tastes, obviously, intolerances. But that I feel I'm back to where I was in early season Game of Thrones, which is where I basically have a fundamental belief that they're trying to do right by the material.
And by the which audience, I lost, I feel, I guess, too, like that there's...
Yeah, by the material, by the audience, and also by the time in which we live, like, which is weird, again, like you say, with fantasy, like, but that they are trying to have some sensitivity to what we bring to the show as an audience in 2022. Yeah. And I appreciate that, because it's so hard to balance everything, right? You've got the book people who were just ideologues about how it should be portrayed, and then you know, just so many different constituencies they have to please. I mean, a shout out to everyone involved, because I think they're really trying their best.
And they're mostly succeeding, which is even better.
And it shows.
One thing I want to say about this episode I thought was a little weird is that, you know, traditionally on Game of Thrones, at least, the ninth episode of the season, the penultimate one, was always the big one where some shocking moment happens or where some big twist happens. And yeah, there's a big, huge change in power in this episode, but we completely expected that, right? I mean, we knew the Greens were going to make this move. There weren't really any surprising big surprises in it, I thought, which was a little weird. Which isn't a bad thing.
But
it's a good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, I love fetishes, but yeah, just that was surprising. It reminds me of that classic Terry Pratchett line in Eric. What's the difference between a kink and a fetish? It's the difference between using a chicken and a feather. I now have an interesting mental image of a rubber chicken.
Okay.
There you go.
At least it's safe.
Not in Laris's hands. Not in Laris's hands. It's not safe.
No.
No chickens were harmed in the making of this podcast.
The rubber chicken did not give consent.
Speaking of barnyard fowl, I do just want to mention Eamon's like angry duck face, which is not.
So
I don't know if it's. But like, I can't unsee it now. And I just, it looks like he's, it works and I love it.
It's a bit nice
deal. There's such a Graham angle to, you know, he's got the Finsta anger. Like, I don't know. It's just, it just really struck me this episode.
The Royal Mallard.
Yeah. Oh, no.
I would like to add a semi-serious point of clarification. I do not want to imply that having either a fetish or a kink is in any way wrong. I just think it's because this is a scene in which clearly there's a power manipulation play. It's clearly not equal opportunities, consensual, fun times with sex, right? So I just wanted to make it clear. I don't want to come off as judgmental.
Yeah, thanks.
Doesn't watch this.
Very important. We are a sex positive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to make that point as well.
Place your place in a safe and consensual way. You guys have at it.
But, it was the lack of consent, even and the exploitation that made it so cringy, awful. Right. Because she clearly wasn't.
Which wasn't into it.
I mean, even if she consented, it was not something she wanted, clearly.
We in the kink community go for enthusiastic consent.
Right.
Yes. Vocal.
Yes.
Vocal consent.
So that's also why the scene is disturbing to me. It's probably problematic in my opinion, because let's have the baddie disabled guy that everyone already hates also have a fetish and make that even cringier. And
it really is
on many accounts.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I reacted to too. And I think too, like having it be, you know, that's two out of two baddies that they've characterized as rapists of some kind, right? And I would constitute that the scene was a kind of rape, or suggest that it was a kind of rape or a sexual assault. And you know, between that and Aegon, like it does, like I was saying before, it feels like they're shorthanding him in ways that they really aren't with other characters, and it's piling up for me in ways that are like very uncomfortable.
A little side note to that, he actually also in that situation pedestalized her in a way, because in different ways, but it's the same thing. We see his foot, see his malformed foot, and the thing he wants to see of anything is just normal, beautiful feet, to be fair, but he wants to just watch them. I think that's what he's about. That's why he is into her, is the you know, ideal woman foot thing.
I will say,
which is not that difficult, is it, really? I mean, it's not that different to Kristen Cole, who idolizes her and sees her as this paragon of beauty and virtue.
Except that, and in a way, it's her purity. You know, while he pleasures himself, like I feel like that's right, like
on her behalf. Well, so did Laris.
Distinction there for me, but
they're both.
Well, I guess just a callback to the whole objectification, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. your thesis originally is the right one.
I will say though, like I clearly am a little bit Sansa myself, because when that scene happened and she was like, oh, it's Larys, oh, it's late or whatever, she like kicked off her shoes. I was like, oh wow, this is like, they're like so comfortable together. And then she put her feet up on the table and I was like, well, that's kind of rude to just like brandish your perfect feet in front of this poor guy who was like, and then he started like staring and I was like, oh no. Oh no.
Look away.
It took me like an embarrassingly.
I don't know what this says about me too, Sarah. Is that I knew exactly what was going to happen.
No, I did not.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she has a real thing, but she can like pick off her shoes in front of stopping the queen for a minute. I'm like, oh my god, I'm such an asshole.
I have
no idea. I saw his foot to begin with, and then I saw him start ogling her feet. I was like,
Oh my god. Yeah.
I know that look.
Oh, that's terrible.
I just need to tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I continue just to feel really sorry for Alison, because I think of the sexual relationship she's had in her life. You know, massively old, decrepit husband. And then, you know, Larys. And that's pretty much, that is the bounds of her sexual experience. I mean, I feel bad for her.
She looks away in both scenes. We see her doing something sexual.
I think that
this is a woman who may never enjoyed sex. I think that's significant.
And I mean, I think that they're making her a very interesting sort of flashpoint for the consent conversation, as you were saying, Bina, for that a modern audience would bring to it, because she is not, you know, openly objecting, and like arguably she's the queen and arguably she should call Kristen Cole, but she's in such a like locked in position, right? That like she really doesn't have the option to say, I mean, just like it might not even occur to her that she could, because of the things that these men are holding over her.
And actually, oh my goodness, so now I feel really silly for bringing up the question I did before, because I think actually the writers are tipping their hat to how they want us to read this. Because you could interpret, maybe I'm overreaching, I probably am. You could interpret the entire Rhaenys conversation with her about, did you never imagine that you could sit on the throne? You're just making a window in someone else's prison tower for yourself. As you know, you could read that onto her sex life. Like, basically, you have only ever been someone who has taken part in sex within the constraints that someone else has put upon you. Like, the whole concept of consent has never really existed for you, because you've just always been constrained in various ways by various people. And, you know, it sounds so stupid. I feel so invested in her for someone I don't really like, but I just really want her to take sexual agency and pleasure in some way. I want her to have the evolution and the growth in her character, to have the confidence and to give herself the permission to actually take control. Her own
I'm sorry
body
to say, Vina, but yeah, brothel yeah. queens ain't it. Unfortunately. That does not seem to be the way that she is going.
I know. But I just feel so bad for Alicent, which is a triumph of writing in itself.
Let's end the episode then. I really enjoyed this conversation, guys.
Thank you.
In general, if you guys out there enjoyed it, as I said to begin with in this episode, just come join us. We're on Discord, Vassals of Kingsgrave. We stand with open arms to anyone who has something intelligent to say, or something naughty, or something else to say. someone who has something to say. We find that interesting and want to welcome it.
But they don't have to have something to say. They can just come and lurk.
Okay. So anyone. No matter if you have anything to say or anything, you're welcome here.
I'll just praise. We like praise as well.
You can just come. Yeah, I really like praise, personally. You can praise me all day long and I will just keep on taking
it. We're the
it.
Agons of the internet. We love your applause.
So on that note, let's do a comment and rule and then finish up this episode. So 3, 2, 1. Oh.
Oh, you guys give me life. This was great.
This is fun, guys.
Yeah. I'm gonna...
I feel like I know more after these and that I have a different perspective, which is a better perspective.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, I think, as I said, I learned something as well, so that's good.
Patrick knows everything, and even he knows
I was amazed myself.
From mere mortals. What
is oh, can I propose new house sanity words? We'll raise our sword for your applause.
Oh, yeah.
That's
honestly too good for us.
I think this next one, Sarah, is too good. You have to leave that one out.
Oh, House Manwoody, we will not yunk anyone's will yum.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, fair.
That's much more on brand.
Well, have a good day, guys.
Okay.
Guys.
Yeah.
Good night.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. Bye. Thanks, Patrick.
No problem.
Thanks, Patrick.
No problem.